You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Reed.
Hello, Bob. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, editor-in-chief of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Reed Hoffman, as you know. You're a very prominent figure in Silicon Valley and, for that matter, well-known elsewhere around the world. You co-founded LinkedIn. You didn't technically co-found OpenAI, but you were present at creation. You were one of the original donors to the nonprofit. In fact, I remember reading about this OpenAI thing in the New York Times about 10 years ago when it was first announced, and seeing your name along with Elon Musk's. And then you were also a first-round investor in the for-profit subsidiary. You were on the OpenAI board for a while. You're still on the Microsoft board. And you've written a number of books, one of which is new and we're going to talk about, called Super Agency: What Could Possibly Go Right with the AI Future. I'm really looking forward to this because, for one thing, I learned a lot from the book. I learned more about the past than I expected, and we'll explain why technological history is relevant to the argument you make. I'm also looking forward to it because, as you know, you and I disagree about how much optimism is in order about our AI future and, accordingly, what our kind of policy approach should be. So, with all that said, anything you want to say before I launch in with my interrogation?
No, other than the fact that, just to remind your listeners that one of the things that I loved your book, Non-Zero, and your other book so much that I reached out to meet, and we've been talking about this for years, and I'm, you're one of the, you know, the people that I most like to be interrogated by.
Well, God bless you. We need more Silicon Valley potentates like you, Reed, who go around saying things like this. You should encourage them to say things like that.
I will, although potentate is not usually my self-descriptor.
I'll tell you, if that's not on your business card, oh, they don't still have business cards, do they? If it's not on your resume or whatever, you're making a mistake, I think.
Yeah. And Bob, just to remind you of this, it's LinkedIn profile, but you know, like, but
a LinkedIn profile. Yes. Actually, even I have a LinkedIn profile. Yes. That's right. In fact, I date the takeoff of my steep career trajectory to the moment that I put my profile on LinkedIn. That's when everything came together. LinkedIn, of course, is now owned by Microsoft, which is related to the fact that you're now on the Microsoft board. Mm-hmm. Your book. Now, I want to start by way of explaining why the past, why technological history is so relevant to it. I want to actually quote a little from the book. So you say, again, the title is Super Agency, which I think is very important. I mean, as it happens, like I'm writing an AI book, and I was writing the part where I deal with the concept of agency as I was preparing for this. So you write that most concerns about AI are concerns about human agency. You go on to say human agency is a fundamental concept in philosophy, sociology, and psychology. It holds that you as an individual have the capacity to make your own choices, act independently, and thus exert influence over your life, while you also believe, you may also believe that external circumstances and conditions play a significant role in the outcomes you experience, it's your sense of agency that compels you to form intentions, set goals, and take actions to achieve these outcomes. A sense of agency then can endow your life with purpose and meaning. Now, I'm going to read a little more that connects this kind of to the technological past. Okay, so you say, with reference to AI, you say, an increasing variety of systems, devices, and machines will encroach on areas traditionally governed by human agency in ways that humans may often find objectionable. And even in instances where we welcome such cognitive offloading, other issues arise. What if, through over-reliance on machine agency and capabilities, our own skills and agency atrophy over time? What if the systems that are supposedly working on our behalf and delivering outcomes we approve of end up shaping our behaviors and choices in ways that we haven't explicitly consented to? And then you write, well, that's actually the story of humanity to date. And I think that'll surprise some people because, you know, we think of AI as kind of this qualitatively new thing, which I think you'd agree in some respects it is. But do you want to elaborate on that or maybe talk about part of technological history that helps you make your case that we can handle this challenge?
Well, I mean, each time is a new time. So I will get to that. But basically, it goes back to like Socrates and the written word and then the printing press and electricity and mainframes. We always have this conversation that when we get a new general technology, we go, oh my God, this is the end of human agency. This is the collapse of human society. And like, for example, the dialogue around the printing press was very similar to parts of the dialogue around AI. Each time, by the way, it's argued that this time is new. It's unlike the other ones, which is, by the way, true. Each time it is a new thing. That's part of what creates the unsettlement of it. But when we look at it, it includes, you know, the car and electricity and planes and the internet and mobile phones. Each time we kind of go through, this is the collapse of human agency. It's collapse of control over our own lives. It's collapse of our capabilities. It's collapse of our social coherence and our ability to make, you know, decisions together in some of them. And each time we've actually, you know, so far in history, each time being a new circumstance, we've made it into greater and better human agency. It doesn't mean it isn't transformed. Doesn't mean some things are lost or some things are changed in ways. But like the level of general human agency around the entire world has gone up significantly. And through technology, as you know, I describe us as homo techne, which we evolve mm-hmm. through technology. And so all of that is kind of setting for how to analyze AI. Because, you know, on one hand, given it's the agentic revolution, it almost steers directly into this classic human fear. It's like the AI will be the agents, not me, right? And it's that not me, which is the classic impulse, because actually, in fact, we have agents. Like, I suspect, Bob, you have a book agent.
I do.
You know, we have people who are agents around us that, you know, you wouldn't say your book agent takes away your agency. Actually, your book agent extends your agency. And so part of the theory about AI being amplification intelligence and extending our agency is, even as we're building agentic AI, co-pilots, other things, that will, over time and over transition, greatly extend our agency, even though, by the way, the transitions are going to be rough. Like, one of the things that I probably undercover in the book is that, you know, even though I describe it as the cognitive industrial revolution, for both the upside but also the transition is the thing that I think, you know, we need to be working on, because that's the area that, you know, agency gets transformed en route to the new and improved super agencies.
Yeah. So I guess a couple of kinds of replies you've already heard. You've been doing a certain amount of talking about the book. I've seen you on a number of prominent media venues, some even more prominent than this one, hard as that may be to imagine. So first of all, as you just said, yeah, the transition can be rough. I mean, in fact, in the aforementioned book, Non-Zero, I go into the printing press and how, you know, it did play this divisive role for a while. Arguably, the wars of religion wouldn't have happened without it. So that took a while. I think the example that would spring to most people's minds is social media. And I think some of them would say it's still not completely clear that we have adapted or will adapt. Now, as I've said to you before, I give you credit for founding the one benign social media platform I know of. LinkedIn, so far as I can tell, has not caused a lot of trouble in the world. You know, you're familiar with Twitter, Facebook, and so on, and the kind of naturally tribalizing effect that some of these have, especially as governed by algorithms designed to maximize engagement. And by the way, we can expect AI to be, by some actor, by some companies at least, to maximize engagement, whatever, that it will be designed to optimize engagement. And they would, I mean, I think you could make the case that Donald Trump might not be president if it weren't for social media. Totally arguable, but if so, that's a, well, by my ideological lights, at least, that's a high price to pay. What do you say to that?
So a couple things. So first, thank you for the the high praise of LinkedIn of not
put
having
that,
created
put that
any
on your resume
problem.
Too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, I founded something that didn't create any particularly massive bad problems. I hope, by the way, it's also elevated a whole bunch of people's lives and work and career and so forth. You know, those small aspirations. The second thing is that I also think that in the social media case, which I agree, many people are concerned that there's a lot of, you know, we're currently still in the absolute midst of the transition of a lot of negative effects. And I've publicly argued some of the transitions that need to happen, which is, you know, not just thinking about social media as being valuable for individuals, but how you bring society or groups into the loop. And part of it has made me really think through what are principles of, you know, kind of free speech and democracy is, because what we want is we want to be learning and getting to a higher truth coefficient by learning. And part of the reason why we have free speech is to make sure that you don't try to politically, you know, quell other speech. And of course, part of what I find entertaining about, and I mean this in a very dark humor way, about the current circumstances, they say, we're pro freedom of speech, but we're going to sue and threaten other people in their speech. And we're going to say, you were trying to be word police, but by the way, now you can't use the word women or sex or diversity and inclusion. And it's like, you know, I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, the kind of up is down, black is white. You know, it's like we need to offer asylum to white South Africans for racial oppression. And you're like, go read the history books. So it's concerning. And I think that one of the things that, you know, I think a variety of media, including social media, played into this. I think cable news is a big thing. I think talk radio is a big thing. I think there's a number of areas where we're not collectively learning in ways that we should be. The point of freedom of speech is to make sure that you don't have this kind of attempt to control the narrative by power and by power over media. And I think that we're in a bleak spot in that in the US currently. And so I think that does need to be, but I think of it as transition, because I can think of ways that social media, cable news, talk radio can work, where they can work with when someone can come and say the moon landing was faked or the world is flat, and you enable the free speech position in order to do that. But you still have a collective learning, kind of circumstance. And, you know, what I've thought about writing about this and I haven't gotten around to it is kind of like vaccination and anti-vaccination as a way of doing it, as a way, because the way we determine truth in human society over, you know, centuries, millennia, is we have groups of people who are expert, engage in something in a reflective manner. It's everything from science and reproducibility and science journals and so forth to, you know, juries, why you have people deliberating on some circumstance to blue ribbon commissions. You know, I think we need to be engaging those kinds of truth processes that isn't just because, I can get a lot of social media attention that what I'm saying is particularly true. And so that's, I think, the broad arc. But with social media, I think we're in the middle. I think we're in this bad transition phase. I don't think that, I think with technology, it's always a question of how you can modify it and where you can get to.
Mm-hmm. Can you imagine AI playing a constructive role here, either on social media or in any other realm where there's intense human conflict? I mean, whether actually kinetic conflict or just passionate and unhealthy opposition.
Yeah, easily. I mean, for example, one of the recent things my friend Adam Grant pointed out to me, which I need to go track down, was that there's been some interesting academic work in AI agents being really persuasive about persuading people out of conspiracy theories. And mm-hmm. I think it was something like 25% of people who thought, you know, the moon landing was faked or the earth is flat, kind of equivalent, changed their mind by interaction with an AI and did so in a way that persisted the kind of the length of the study, which was, you know, 6 months plus or something like that. And so, you know, you can imagine AIs being extremely helpful because as opposed to the, you know, like when you and I are arguing, Bob, it's like, you know, our human egos and it's like, oh, I must be right. And I can't possibly agree that, you know, Bob has changed my mind about this, you know, while we're talking about this on the phones or like all these human foibles, the AI agents can sidestep those. And they also are the greatest learning technology we have created in human history. And so the ability to do that and all the rest of that, when you get into even in-depth human conflicts, and I'll say something that's kind of mildly, you know, pedestrian, but I think valuable. One of the things that I've already seen happen with, like, you know, my company Inflection's Pi personal intelligence, is people using it as a counselor when they're having an argument with their spouse, right? There's kind of like the, you know, well, when Reed was saying this, maybe he meant this, or Reed, did you mean this when you were saying this? And that kind of thing. And those are like some of the most deep kind of questions around places where it can be helpful. And I think that it's a question of what we build and how we design. And I understand economic incentives and so forth, which I expect we're going to be getting into during our conversation. You know, I think it can be really great for these human-to-human conflict issues. Obviously, it can also be used poorly, but their goal is to make it mostly great and limited poorly.
Yeah, no, you've just alluded to something that I have some hope for, which is using it to expand cognitive empathy, by which I don't mean like feeling sorry for people, feeling their pain. I just mean perspective taking, theory of mind. Like, it's such a common failing, you know, in couples that are having a fight, to understand like what it is you did that triggered the other person, for example. And one of the surprises initially, I mean, an example of a so-called emergent property of AI, a controversial term, but we discovered early on that these LLMs are actually very good at surmising what's going on in someone's head. I wrote about this. I gave ChatGPT an elaborate test, and it kind of blew my mind. So I have hope for that. I have a lot of hope, actually. I worry that the incentive structure at various levels won't lead to the hopes prevailing. As for talking people out of conspiracy theories, I mean, that's an interesting example. I remember the study. Now, one of the conspiracy theories they talked people out of in that study was that there was a conspiracy behind the JFK assassination. Now, that's interesting because it's not clear there wasn't, right? There is non-crazy people. In fact, I'm taping a conversation later today with Jeff Morley, who's an expert among people who do believe there was a conspiracy. He's possibly the best versed of all. There was just this release of Kennedy documents. But the point is, like, what is and isn't a dubious conspiracy theory lies in the eyes of the beholder, and the persuasive powers of AI can be used for good or for ill. I mean, there was another study about a year ago that showed that, so it compared LLMs and people in getting people to change their views on certain policy issues. And it found that they were about equally good, but if you gave them both a little bit of demographic data about the people they're trying to persuade, just basic stuff, age and so on, the LLM was actually better, okay? Now, if you imagine an LLM taking advantage of all the information about me in my social media feed and just sizing me up to a T and then using all that to persuade me of something, that's a tremendous amount of power. And I think we have every reason to think it'll be better than people, not to mention just faster and able to replicate itself and so on. And that can be used by bad actors. And That leads to questions, concerns about centralization of AI power and so on. So, my basic worry, you cannot stop technological progress. My basic worry is it's going to proceed so fast that it'll be hard for us to adapt in all kinds of realms, job displacement, whatever, even if the people go on to find other jobs and so on, that it'll be disruptive in the bad sense of the word. And, you know, some people who you have this interesting taxonomy of views on AI: doomers, gloomers, zoomers, and bloomers. I'm not sure I'm in any of those, but there is a common, some people are on the one hand very kind of, in a sense, anti-AI, and yet one thing they do is keep questioning actually how effective it is anyway. I don't understand that view. Like, if you don't think it's very powerful, why are you worried? I think it's incredibly powerful, and I'm worried. I think this is going to be an earthquake, and that's my concern.
So I'd say first, I think it will be an earthquake. So I agree there. I also think that, you know, part of it is that I don't think there's any real way to, and this is a human nature point, I don't think there's any real way to slow it down. Because if I know anything about human beings, we kind of divide into group, have different cognitive theories of the world. We compete with each other, whether that's companies, industries, societies, countries, et cetera. And so, you know, there's not going to be one unified theory of this. I mean, we don't even have a unified theory of climate change, which is like more visibly apparent, right? And just based off simple analyses from physics and like warming and other kinds of things as ways of doing this. And even then, you know, you've got, you know, climate change deniers and, you know, all the rest of this stuff. So I tend to think human beings do all that, and that's part of the technological creation, which is part of the reason why we're going down the road. And so I tend to say the speed clock is set by this human group competition. And then you say, well, how do you best shape it? And the best shape it is, well, let's make sure that the kinds of AIs that we most want to get created, we most want to have influence human life, societies, work, etc., are being created within that speed clock. But then, by the way, also kind of arguing that that actually there's advantages to the speed clock. It's not just a, you know, gloomer designed, you know, like, I know it's going to happen, it's going to be terrible. It's to say that actually, in fact, the things that can be created can be so good that not only we get great upside in the future, but we also get better safety, better human alignment, et cetera, in the future. And so getting into the future can easily be shaped to a good thing. The transition will be very difficult, and that's the earthquake point that I agree with. Mm-hmm. And so, but part of even agreeing with the earthquake point is to say, you say, well, why be optimistic versus pessimistic? And the answer is, you know, you only get to the futures that are good by steering towards them. You don't get to the futures that are good by trying to steer away from the bad futures. It's like, you know, metaphorically say, you're going to drive from, you know, New Jersey to New York. And you say, my plan is to avoid every piece of traffic and every piece of pothole. And that's what I'm really doing. He's like, well, you're never going to get to New York. You have to actually, you know, have a plan to kind of how do you get there and which risks you take and which potholes you're going to run over and so forth. And that's actually, in fact, the same kind of reason. And so it's not so much optimism because, and this is the bloomer perspective, because you think everything is going to be golden and sunshine and, you know, roses and daffodils. As much as it's going to be, hey, getting there will be really great. It may be some difficult driving and some bad weather on the way, but like let's navigate through it.
Yeah, and just to extend that metaphor, what you don't want to do is keep the accelerator down all the way.
Exactly.
And I would say, in effect, that is our current policy because, whenever. If anyone proposes a regulation, and I agree, it's hard to regulate in advance when the risks haven't really manifested in concrete terms and so on. But if you propose that, or if you even say, look, why should the government be subsidizing energy for these AI companies, which they would like? I don't know if there's much of it's going to go on. But if you even like ask a question like that, let alone do what I would say, which is, look, remember, climate change is a problem. And I know these AI companies buy green credits and stuff. But the fact is, if you like, in the short term, radically increase energy demand, some of it's going to be carbon based. It's going to hurt. It's going to be bad for climate change. And in addition, again, I think slower is better. So I would say, why not actually have an energy surtax for these data centers? But anyway, my point is, I don't want to argue that. My point is, if you say anything about anything that might slow AI down or hinder these companies in any way, You get the reply that not only are you, quote, stifling innovation, but China will beat us. That has become the refrain of these AI companies. And I think I won't get into which of the AI CEOs I think actually believe that ideologically and which are being cynical, but it's pretty unanimous now. So I guess in a way, my question is, if you agree that you wouldn't want to drive to whatever your destination is with the accelerator all the way down, how could we be going any faster than we're going on it? It seems that we have a de facto accelerationist policy. These companies are basically completely unhindered, and any suggestion of anything other than full speed ahead gets you accused of being like a communist or something. And so that's my line.
So first, I actually don't think the companies are going at kind of the absolute maximum depression of acceleration. They all the ones that I'm associated with have, you know, call it safety and alignment groups that are, you know, 100 plus, sometimes in like the Microsoft case, hundreds of people who are working on, like, what could the possible risks be? You know, Microsoft has multiple checks on the releases of the technology for kind of human quality and human evolution quality in this. And obviously, if they were fully accelerationist, they would not do that. Right? They just put it out there and see how it goes. Now, why are they doing it? Because you say, well, the government didn't mandate them doing it. Well, they're doing it for the reasons that I describe, as you know, some depth in the book, is that part of actually how we steer towards better human futures is not because there's a central government human regulatory industry or bureaucrat who is imagining their theory of the future of the case, which I think is frequently wrong and bad, because no individual, I wouldn't even put myself in this role, can actually do that. You use networks of human beings, networks of customers, networks of employees, networks of talking to journalists, networks of talking to skeptical people like Bob, right? To kind of surface what are the, you know, kind of challenges. And then you do some kind of best theory guess about what are the things that are important to do and sooner. And you're iterating and you're measuring and learning as you're doing that. And that's part of the reason why, you know, we're not in a place where people, like, we've had this really powerful technology for a couple of years. And that doesn't mean, you know, hey, it's all fine, you know, go to sleep. But it's to say, look, the organization as functioning is actually, in fact, putting a lot of energy in this. And that's the reason why, one, is it's not maximum accelerationist. Two is on the China side. You know, when I was last year, when I was arguing that we're in an economic race with China, a number of people, not just you, would tell me that, oh, you're arguing this because you're one of those Silicon Valley accelerationists saying, you know, leave me alone. Don't get in my way at all.
Actually, I didn't say that to you. Yeah. I said that about you behind your back. Yeah, I don't recall saying it to you. No, I'm all kidding. Right. I didn't.
No, I think we actually had this conversation at Satori.
I don't think I questioned your motives.
First of all,
I don't consider you, historically, you've been relatively pro-engagement on China, I think.
Yes, I still am.
Yeah, but there has been a turn in Silicon Valley generally, and you may have been somewhat susceptible to it yourself. There is China hawkism has swept Silicon Valley and the nation pretty fast.
Yeah, and actually, I think my view of China is co-opetition. Like, I think we need to be both cooperating and competing. I think that we're better off as a society, better off for the U.S., better off for the world in doing that. And so that's my argument. But it does involve an intense competition as well. And so, which I was before. And then now, of course, DeepSeek came out. And then it was like, great. No, I'm not actually, in fact, just arguing China as the bugbear to say, allow me to roam unhindered. And by the way, I do think that I thought the Biden executive order was very good. I think being very specific and selective and within a channel of iterative deployment is actually very good on regulatory.
You're talking about the AI thing. You're not now talking about the chip restrictions, although you may support those, but you're talking about the AI, which was largely about reporting, being very transparent, especially about the development of powerful models and reporting certain things. And now Trump has trashed that, and I guess he may replace it with something, but yeah.
Yeah. And my hope is that they'll replace it with something similar and just call it the new
problem. He's been known to do that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And just that. Because I think it was well constructed. It was bringing the companies in and pressing them very hard on what the kind of things they could do and what they could start doing in order to make this navigation better. And that's part of the reason why I don't think we're at a crazy accelerationist basis. And we could be even more accelerationist than we are. The subsidizing energy strikes me as not particularly the best use of public funds. So, in as much as that's happening, I think the companies can kind of pay their own way on the stuff. They may need help with regulatory of building lots of new energy and data centers, which I think is good for society. I mean, one of the things that I think is frequently, because everyone calls out every argument in order to argue against these things. Is AI bad for climate change? And you're like, well, actually, in fact, all the hyperscalers are investing massively in green energy on a venture basis to get it constructed. That could then be more useful to the rest of society. Also, when you apply intelligence to everything, like intelligence, for example, to grid management, you get that better. And AI is an intelligence revolution. So that's another area where I actually think it'll be net very positive. So anyway, so I think that there's a lot of spurious arguments in these things. But the subsidy, I don't think is like, there's a lot of things that I would want to be, if I were subsidizing stuff around AI, I would be subsidizing the creation of, call it medical and work help for everyday people, everyday Americans, to navigate the transition. That's what I would be going, let's incent that, let's subsidize that. Let's have a medical assistant that's running on every smartphone for free for every American. That would be the kind of thing I'd say, hey, that's a good subsidy. Those are the reason why I'm not think we're as crazy accelerationist as perhaps your language suggests.
Yeah, I should emphasize first. I mean, the main reason I'd like to see a tax on data center energy consumption is to actually slow things down a little. I should add that I'd want to do that. Well, I'll get back to China later. On the acceleration point, I take your point that all of these companies, first of all, they have people devoted to some alignment research, trying to figure out how we can make these things safe, and they invest a fair amount of real energy into it. But I think to some extent, they are inevitably involved in an arms race dynamic that if they're going to be companies in the private sector, they just can't afford to ignore. And now in your book, you say you don't like the use of the term arms race to describe AI if it's meant to conjure up like nuclear arms. OK, but I think that, just in the generic sense of an arms race, the kind you have in evolution and so on, you have that in any healthy part of the private sector. And I think you see it in AI. And a good example, you mentioned DeepSeek. So that model came out from China, freaked people out. Sam Altman tweeted, okay, we will move some releases up or something. We will move some things up. And very, very soon, they released Deep Research. Now, Deep Research was powered by the O3 reasoning model. And they hadn't even put out a system card on the O3, which is what you normally do, right? You normally, you've done the safety research and you put out the system card and so on. They hadn't done that because they hadn't released O3 as a standalone. But, you know, I had Dan Hendricks, you may well know who he is, on the show around that time. And they were in the process of testing it. He wasn't sure, but he was saying it looked like, I mean, he said, first of all, look, this hasn't been through the standard safety stuff that is visible, because normally when they're putting out a new model, like you know, Dan Hendricks is part of the network that knows like what they're doing. And they go through this process. And apparently in that case, under the competitive pressure of DeepSeek, Sam Altman, it looks like he broke with protocol and released the thing faster than you might otherwise. By the way, separate from that, this new Chinese, Chinese company came out with this thing called Manus, which is like deep research plus the OpenAI operator agent on steroids. And I think lots of people agree that that had not undergone even preliminary safety stuff. Well, at least it hadn't undergone as much as one would hope. And that if in fact these kinds of agents were so common on the internet that there were bad actors out there trying to do these so-called prompt injections, it would have been very vulnerable to them. So that's an example of a Chinese company in the commercial arms race, playing fast and loose. And it's just like, it's inherent in the dynamics of an arms race that you get this kind of recklessness. And just to jump to one of my other, you know, beliefs, I think the Chinese thing points to the fact that regulation at the national level is not alone. We need to agree on some rules of the road with China about safety and so on. And because an agent like that is as much a threat to us as to China. I mean, even if it's not released in America, and it's pretty damn hard to keep it, any AI model out of America, but it's still the internet. We're part of the internet, and the destruction this agent could wreak is our destruction. So I just think we cannot afford to go through the AI revolution while engaged in a cold war with China, which we seem to be, and which is being encouraged by the AI companies. They are actively, explicitly encouraging us to fear China. Just look at the three reports they all put out in response to the Trump administration's request for feedback. I mean, maybe you can convince me I'm wrong, but I think it's a very pernicious dynamic where it's in their commercial interest. And they, look, they're not different from anybody else. I mean, people appeal to what they can appeal to pursue their self-interest. It's in the interest of these companies to not be regulated, to get subsidies, whatever. And they're playing the China card. And I think it's very unhealthy and very dangerous. That is my take.
Well, you know, I think we have to have you sit down with a AI to help you persuade you to, you know, relax and enjoy the future. And, you know, we'll get right into the...
This is my other concern. You're going to sedate all the leftists. This is my concern. Anyway, go ahead.
That was teasing. In case the irony doesn't come through the podcast. I do think that it is, of course, the case, like, and part of my objection to the term arms race is that arms race tends to be emphasized on weapons. And I don't think that there's zero weapons issue here, but if you call it a foot race or a hands race, I'd probably be more sympathetic to the language. And I do think that in these races, the races does create various forms of incentive dynamic to take extra risks, to you were talking about the prompt injections and other kinds of things that happens. That'll happen between the companies in China and the companies in the US and elsewhere. That'll happen between industries and societies. And in the arms case and weapons, it'll happen in that case too. And I think that all of that's going to happen. And I'm not if I were more optimistic about the kind of state of international geopolitics and their ability to coordinate on this, then I would be more, you know, then I would think that that would be a more interesting set of, you know, agreements to engage. Part of the reason I'm negative on that is I look at something that I think is as straightforward as climate change. And, you know, you can say it's straightforward because you can do the measurements. You can say it's straightforward because you can say, hey, look, all this stuff, we can do basic physics. It, of course, increases heat, et cetera, et cetera, increases the amount of particles in the atmosphere. And even that can't get to the geopolitics of agreement on, let alone something that's abstract and a possibility for the future. Versus, you know, something that's physical and right now and visible. And so, you know, I tend to go to the important thing then is not like I disagree with you trying to slow it down, a la let's do an energy tax to slow it down. I just don't think it should necessarily be, you know, like I think that the public effort should be how do we help us with the transition? How do we help us make sure that there are things that are aligned with us versus slowing it down? And I think that, that kind of question about how we're, you know, in cooperation with China, I do think it's a kind of a question about like, well, which ways will this be human elevating? Which superpowers will be most focused? Which ways will it be integrated in society? Which ways will be integrated in industry? And I think that's the thing that I'm, you know, when I'm trying to win a race, that's the thing I'm trying to win. By the way, and that winning is also inclusive of how do we, you know, navigate risks. I mean, one of the things that I've been doing for, you know, almost 10 years now is facilitating conversations between the major technology creators, the major companies, the major labs, to kind of say, hey, let's be safe. Let's be exchanging our safety cases. Let's be exchanging our security cases. Like what's the kind of testing we should be doing and releasing? What are the kinds of concerns? And like the kind of things that play out are, well, if it gets into a certain kinds of self-improvement cycle, then we should possibly really slow down on that and really examine it. If it's developing languages and communication that we can't follow, that we can't make human readable, then that's another thing that we should be much more deeply concerned about. So there are things, and by the way, that's putting in time. That's part of the reason why I was saying is that we're not actually, in fact, you know, just massively accelerationist, because it's like, well, no, we're investing in time and figuring out what the development cycle looks like, even in advance of what I argue in the book, which is iterative deployment gives the best possible way of keeping humanity in the loop. And so anyway, so those are some kind of, you know, not completely unsympathetic, you know, reflections on your argument, but also, you know, partial agreement and partial disagreement.
Okay. Let's see. The I would say, you know, speaking of Dan Hendricks, he co-authored something you may have seen with Eric Schmidt and the co-founder of Scale AI, Alexander Wang, I think.
Yes.
On superintelligent strategy. And that's what Dan and I largely discussed in that conversation. I encourage people to listen to it. But it points to a dangerous dynamic with China, I think. It then suggests that there's maybe a more naturally stabilizing force that's analogous to mutually assured destruction with nuclear weapons. I disagree with that. I don't think that force is, that they describe as naturally stabilizing. But I think they're right that there is a danger in a kind of a race between us and China to get to superintelligence, which is, I'm sure, what this looks like to China, China, if they fell... if they were behind by very far, and or if they weren't behind by that far, but do conceive of this AGI superintelligence thing as like this distinct threshold after which there's this takeoff that puts you in the driver's seat if you get there first, which a lot of people in America believe, I mean, are saying. So anyway, there is a danger that as either side really perceives the other one of getting that threshold, they have to get like physical. They have to like do sabotage, maybe even bomb data centers, so that it is a destabilizing thing. To that, I would add, and I apologize to the listeners who have heard me say this at least a half a dozen times, if they listen to all my podcasts, the chip restrictions on China on Chinese chip imports do have the effect of reducing the disincentive on China's part to invade Taiwan, because they're now getting less out of those factories than there were before. They're not getting, at least not through legitimate channels, they're not getting the best chips out of those factories. The fact that they were used to be thought of as kind of a deterrent to invasion, because the factories are probably not going to fare well in anywhere war. So that disincentive has been somewhat reduced. In any event, do you don't worry about the this destabilizing dynamic I described that comes through in the Hendricks paper?
Well, obviously, I would characterize myself as significantly worried about geopolitics generally in the current times. But also, you know, I think that a lot of the ways that we engage with China is suboptimal. I'm a supporter of the CHIPS Act because I do think that the notion of that we are in
now wait, there's the CHIPS Act that subsidizes factories, chip factories in the U.S., and then there's the chip restriction.
Yeah, I'm in favor of both.
Those are okay. You favor both.
Yeah, and part of it is because I do think that there's a question. I do think the Chinese already act in various ways for mercantilist competition. I mean, they don't allow many U.S. technology companies to operate in China. They put various kind of nationalist restrictions on that. I tend to think that, you know, the right way to frame the discussion around TikTok is not about a question of speech questions, but a question of industrial parity, right? Mm-hmm. You know, allow U.S. companies to operate in China, will allow Chinese companies to operate here. And I think that part of the question around, you know, the technological development, and I do think that the Chinese are one of the major countries that engages in fairly deep economic IP espionage, you know, are kind of real challenges. And I think the chip restrictions are one of the things to do that. It doesn't mean it prevents them. People will say, well, but see, look, they're still doing it. Yeah, it's a slowing factor. Now, relative to the Taiwanese incentives questions, you know, I think that the entire world, everyone should be behind every particular society's self-determination characteristics, as long as those self-determination are internal and domestic versus external. And so I'm, you know, very positive on the Taiwanese deciding their own future. And so I don't think just because you say, hey, it's creating an incentive to the Chinese government to be more aggressive with the Taiwanese, I think that's like saying, you know, supporting Ukraine is creating incentives for Putin. And I believe intensely in.
I do think NATO expansion was a mistake, actually, but that's another conversation. Yeah. And that's not to take away from the fact that, again, you can condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine and still say it was unwise foreign policy to do anything that increased the chances of it happening. But that's a separate. My point is, I'm not saying the Chinese invasion of Taiwan would be justifiable. I'm saying that the result could be so catastrophic that we should be very careful about doing anything that makes it more likely.
Well, I do think we should be careful about that, but I think there's other reasons on the chip restrictions that make them a good sense to do. So, like for example, trying to navigate the Taiwanese situation is an important variable, but is not the only variable, right, in this. And so I actually think that the questions about how, because I think we're in industrial revolution race, and I think that the cognitive industrial revolution is something that's super important to do. And by the way, one of the things to focus on, part of the reason I wrote Super Agency and, you know, I'm kind of making this happen is that one of the things that I think is part of that cognitive industrial revolution and its race is adoption. And I think one of the things that I'm already seeing in China is I think that they are embracing the adoption future in a way that's much more aggressive than our, you know, kind of Western democracies. You know, for example, BYD, which is a, you know, kind of massively successful creating electric vehicles, thing, car is actually, in fact, trying to roboticize all of their factories as fast as they possibly can. And you'd say, well, but wait a minute, you know, China already has a lower cost of labor and everything else. And yeah, they understand that the question is you're going to where you are in the future of this. And so more robotization is part of what makes you competitive 5, 10 years, 15 years. And that's the kind of thing that when you're thinking about these race dynamics, you need to be doing and need to be going towards. Because if you're not skating to where the puck's going, but rather only where the puck is currently, you're going to be left behind.
Mm-hmm. So as you know, Reed, the time comes when we go into what we call overtime, which is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter, which you can become by clicking on a link in the show notes, going to the Non-Zero newsletter and signing up. We encourage that. I want to give you a chance to say anything else before we go behind the paywall, to say anything else you want to say about your book. I also want to say that in introducing it originally, Super Agency, What Could Possibly Go Right with Our AI Future, I did not mention your co-author, Greg Beato. That is the way he pronounces his name, right?
It is.
Yeah, very nice guy. I met him in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Very well-written book and very well-thought-out book. And as I said, one thing I enjoyed was the trip into some of the technological past. And there's something I want to talk about a little in overtime that's related to that. So you go into things like the history of like GPS and relatedly Google Maps. And one argument I think you make effectively is that often technologies are taken as being more zero sum than they are, as more extractive than they are. And people got a ton of benefits out of Google Maps. I do want to just hint, I'm going to ask you in overtime, are there any things about what AI is doing that make you a little sad? And I'm going to go ahead and give you my example about Google Maps right now, which is, look, on balance, it saved me a ton of time. It's been a huge benefit. But there's something that used to be part of my life that no longer is, that was actually very important, I now realize. And that's people asking me for directions. That can be one of the most rewarding experiences in life. The last time it happened, about 3 years ago, it was somebody from a very different, like, socioeconomic and ethnic background. And I got so much pleasure out of being able to steer him to this bar whose location happily I knew, and happily I gave him the right directions. I mean, the downside of this is when they drive off and you think, oh shit, was I, you know, that's terrifying. But that's just a little thing. And it's kind of analogous, you know, these technologies can have their isolating aspects as well as their communal aspects. And so I'm going to ask you in overtime, are there moments when even somebody fairly optimistic about like this, this like you, goes, you know, this makes me a little sad. That's going to be the question. But before we go into overtime, I want to give you a chance to say anything else about the book, Super Agency.
Well, I look forward to having the overtime conversation as well, and I will answer in overtime. So, as a little bit of a teaser prompt for anyone who may want to go engage in the overtime, what I'd say is that part of what I'm trying to do with Super Agency, and part of what Greg and I are trying to do, and I am an enthusiastic plus 10 to your praise of Greg. What I'm trying to do is help people who might be AI uncertain, AI fearful, AI skeptical, add in AI curious, to be engaged in ways that go, oh, what could possibly go right? And what would be the way? And why should that be part of what I'm thinking about as well, even if I'm thinking about what could go wrong? And why putting that equally as what could possibly go right is really important. And what they, as you note, the history of why it is we, you know, like when we read the criticisms of the printing press, and maybe it was actually the religious war place, Non-Zero, maybe in the first place that I actually really encountered the cost structure for that. Now, you know, we would want to minimize that cost structure because we as human beings tend to fuck up the, you know, technical term, tend to, you know, bring in the new technologies. And that's part of the thing in the printing press. Let's try to navigate this one better. And that's why steering towards good things is what I think is is most important while navigating the bad things, and hence trying to persuade everyone to become a bloomer.
Okay. Well, thank you. So now we will go into overtime and find out whether Reed every once in a while feels a tinge of kind of anticipatory nostalgia or something about like what might be lost as part of the technological future. Thanks, everybody, who stayed with us this far. I hope you'll follow us into overtime.